103.2 Dublin City FM. It's Mental Wealth with Brian Green here for the next 28 minutes. If you want to get in touch, you can email the programme, as always, at mentalwealth@briangreen.com. It's episode 7 and I've been away for a couple of weeks, but we're back on track. And today's guest I have with me, I was going to stay in studio, but we're more kind of out and about on site, is Colman Nochter. Colman is a child and adolescent psychoanalytical psychotherapist. And when Colman does interviews on the radio, people usually then take a breath after saying this job title because it's very, very long. How are you, Colman?
Hey, Brian. How's it going?
Good. Tell us a bit about that job title. What kind of work do you do?
Well, primarily I'm a psychotherapist who works primarily with the young people. So that would qualify as children and adolescents. So basically, I tend to work with anyone really between the ages, really, I guess, from 5 or 6 up until the age of 18. And as a psychotherapist, my primary kind of discipline is psychoanalysis. So that's dealing with kind of the unconscious motivations for why we feel the way we feel and, you know, probably trying to look through what has happened in people's lives to make them feel the way they, and the lens with which they see the world, and trying to, I guess, challenge negative lenses with which young people can develop, whether it's low mood or anxiety or maybe eating disorder, something like that, and trying to help them to look at things a little bit differently.
When people come to you, I guess they're in trouble or some sort of distress and you help them work through those problems. Can I ask you a question, not about that cohort of people, but the population in general, the younger population? How are we tuned in with the world? Are we, you know, happy with our lot in general?
I think from the point of view of there's a huge motivation to try and make the world a better place for young people at the moment, and I think thankfully mental health is part of that agenda. But I think we don't fathom the differences in the world in which children exist today that compared to perhaps someone of my generation. I think the whole landscape of their social world is completely different. And I think with the best will in the world as adults, we're trying to get it, but it becomes ever more difficult in the way in which things are changing, I think.
Is there any comparison so that, you know, parents and adults can understand what they're going through? Is it like transistor radios and the youth of the 1960s? What is the comparison to the technology that's now in the hands of young children, and compare that to a time past, or is it comparable?
It is. I mean, I think from the point of view of the incidences are no different. I mean, when we were young people, we wanted to spend more time with our friends than we did with our family. So the desire is no different than it ever was before. You know, and as teenagers, maybe we were interested in exploring kind of sexuality, etc. But it was limited in terms of the degree to which we could do that. What's different now is the quality and quantity of access that young people have in order to resolve questions around growing up, sexuality, friendships, relationships is so vast and so complex that it becomes a far more confusing experience. So something that in every case is tricky to negotiate adolescence, it has now become, I would say, 1,000 times more complex because the gravity of the feedback and the degree to which young people can explore is overwhelming. So I think the motivations for what makes adolescence difficult is no different, but the quantity and quality of that experience is vastly different.
When I was growing up in the 70s, there would be some degree of stranger danger and there would be the man in the white van kind of urban legends and moral panics that would go around the estate and the community. Is there a kind of a misconception that people's difficulties with online engagement will be with persons unknown rather than the problem being things that they do themselves with persons they do know?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's almost like that kind of crime levels have not increased, but our fear of crime has increased. And so I think in terms of we oftentimes think perhaps in physical neighbourhood stuff that our child could be abducted and something could happen to them. It's far more likely that a child who ends up being traumatised through abuse is going to that's going to be done to somebody who is known to them rather than the stranger danger element. And I think in terms of online, there's I don't want to minimize the risk of coming across predators online, and you know, there certainly are people, unsavory people online who attempt to contact children and young people with sinister motives. But most of the complex kind of relationships that children end up in terms of, in my view, would be amongst friends almost. You know, it's that complicated social dynamic of perhaps, you know, you and I, when we were out, I might have said something about you and somebody might have told you, but there was no real proof for that. Whereas now, with screenshots and, you know, the ability to make things much more complex, I think young people perhaps are typing or writing down something that gets them into all kinds of political friendship dynamics that are problematic. And I think lots of young people who, you know, may have made a fool of yourself in front of six people, that was hard to recover from. It might have taken some time. The ability to share something now has meant that you now make a fool of yourself in front of perhaps 6,000 people. And that's a vastly different recovery to try and pull that back. And I think traditionally we learn through adolescence by making mistakes, and we learn socially by making mistakes. And the old social faux pas about, you know, I suppose making an idiot of yourself in front of a girl that you fancy or something like that, that's still a characteristic of the social landscape. But again, the implications for that are vastly different.
You mentioned the neighbourhood, and I've heard you mention before the analogy between the child and the city, and them having the skills to go navigate that city, and that city being the internet. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, I think our physical neighbourhoods have never been smaller. In terms of, we don't tend young people don't tend to kind of hang around in greens and, you know, mix. And I again think back to my own adolescence, and most of the laboratory of life that I learned about was on the 65 bus going to and from school, where it was kind of an unsupervised place where all my male and female friends just hung out and we learned about each other, all that sort of stuff. But with the virtual environment has never been bigger. It means that the internet is a portal to the outside world. And Stephen Fry makes the comparison to the internet being like a city, where there, of course, there are some wonderful museums and some wonderful educational opportunities, but there are also some seedy red light areas that, you know, are dangerous. And I think we perhaps are sending young people out into that city of the internet without the skills to equip them to, if they take a wrong turn or if they come across something that they don't feel able to manage, can they respond to that, or can they get help? And I think there is a paradox of safety that, and I would hear parents say, you know, I think he's safe because he's up in his room, but we don't know where he is and who he's relating to. And you know, parents will say, well, I gave him a smartphone at 10 because I want him to be able to contact me and let me know where he is. So they get a text and say, I'm over in Paul's house, which is around the corner. They feel relieved. But the paradox is, he could get that message from anywhere to say that I'm around in Paul's house. And so, you know, does it appease a certain level of anxiety but also increase risk on the other hand? And I think that notion of our local communities and our global communities, I think the internet has mobilized us, and so we live in a kind of a global village in real terms. So again, you'd hear young people who maybe say, the parents might say, he plays the Xbox and he's talking to his friend David, and they think David is the kid who lives 2 miles down the road. It turns out David is a 59-year-old man in Arkansas. And so there's lots of risks that I think come with the internet that perhaps we need to be educating young people better around the decision making. I don't think it's I think people can get stuck on surveillance and that it's about, you know, parental controls and these sorts of things. I don't think a parental control substitutes parenting, if that makes sense. And so we need to be having conversations with our young people about what to do if they come across something online, because chances are, when they come across something online that they shouldn't, you're not going to be there.
To what degree would it be media literacy that would be the solution, that if people were coached as to what to expect as they enter into this city, into this world?
I think there's a case for that, but some of the research studies done across Europe has said that the more digitally savvy children are, that the higher risk they are from that point.
They're more engaged.
Yeah, but they're also more exposed. So it's almost like almost dialing up the emotional savvy of being aware of what somebody online might want from you when they make a request for, you know, and you know, this, lots of young people have gotten in trouble where they've maybe sent images of themselves to someone and then they're being blackmailed for it. And, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, and it's not just young people. I mean, you can get, you know, there's things that come around, you know, a fake ad from Dundeal saying, I'll buy your car and I'll give you 10 grand over what you want for it. And as adults, we fall foul of that sort of trickery too. But something about adult adjustment means you can judge there's something sus about this and I need to kind of think about that rather than diving in. And so it's more developing that sense of almost trying to provide children with life experience that they haven't had yet to be able to negotiate that space rather than making them more media literate or digitally savvy, if that makes sense.
To put you on the spot then, where's that going to come from? Is it the classroom in school? Is it an open relationship with parents? Is it from their peers? Where are they going to get it from?
I think there's a multi-pronged responsibility. I certainly think schools have a role in how they manage children's relationship with technology. And I say that because I think that's the key part of it. There are young people out there who you'd have no concerns about their online stuff because, you know, they take it or leave it. There are other children there who have a much more unhealthy relationship. So I would see tech in the same way as we might see food or gambling or alcohol. It's something that some people moderately engage in, no problem, and others perhaps it brings out more vulnerability in them. And so from that point of view, we need to be able to, there's a role in education to kind of manage that relationship. Parents most certainly have a relationship to their children that needs to be open and be able to engage in their online world. It's not, I don't think it's good enough to kind of take an ostrich approach and say, they'll come to me if something's wrong. I think the relationship has to be there. But more importantly, I worry about the relationship that children have with themselves. And I think I have a strong belief that the smartphone has become a kind of an anti-boredom device, which means that young people don't spend a lot of time with themselves. In my view, the most important relationship we'll ever have in our lives is our own relationship with ourselves. And I just wonder, are we giving children an opportunity to even have the space and time to develop that when we fill every moment with distraction? And you know, there's a big drive for mindfulness at the moment as a kind of a really in vogue therapeutic engagement, and I wouldn't want to diss mindfulness. I think it's really useful, but I think its popularity has probably come because we live in a mindless sort of society where there isn't space to reflect and think about our next move. And it's that almost thoughtfulness and being able to have a good relationship with who am I, what are my strengths, what are my limitations, that I don't know whether we're giving children an opportunity to have that time.
Are you talking about self-esteem?
I am. I think that's a hugely important part. I mean, there's
where do you get that from? Like, if you were to, I know you don't get it from Amazon, but like, where should we be looking for that in the world today? Where would young people build their self-esteem?
Well, I think the first thing to clarify is that, and I think probably for your listeners, self-confidence and self-esteem are different. And I think that's a big thing that people mix up. I'd have parents come to me and say, I'd love my child to be more confident. Your confidence is your ability to execute an activity or the way in which you project yourself into the outside world. So you can be very confident at doing a certain thing. That doesn't necessarily reflect your self-esteem. Your self-esteem is your relationship with yourself. So that notion that, you know, you believe that you have skills and qualities that allow you to develop resilience to take the hits that life will inadvertently throw at you. So you learn that through, yes, you learn it through feedback from your peers, but it has to be meaningful feedback. And I think for young people, the feedback that they get about, you know, we see ourselves through the eyes of the other. So how I see myself is based on the feedback that I get through other people. And that's that's something that's learned from infancy. But now the feedback is so plentiful and so it's such a deluge of feedback, it almost loses the quality of what it is. So the feedback that you get from someone who knows you very well might be inherently different from the feedback you might get from someone who doesn't know you very well. So self-esteem is about that quality of feedback, which as a person you are open to believing and taking on board. So self-esteem is about self-value, self-worth and self-belief as much as it is about saying positive things about me.
I am an adult, and as of today, I am 10 years on Twitter. And over the 10 years, it has risen and it has waned, but it's still a very, you know, fruitful platform for activity in social media. But the return on investment I would get from it being in the space of Twitter is that you do something and you don't get any response. And as an adult, I can take that on board. I'm happy with how I'm conversing there. But for a younger person, it must be like some level of amplification as to if they don't get that echo, if they don't get that feedback, how must they feel when they go into social media?
Well, I think when you share something, probably something about yourself online, you're announcing an aspect of your identity. So this is something, so even if it's something frivolous like something you're eating or a cup of coffee or whatever, you're saying something about yourself and putting it out there. And you're putting it out there with the threat of judgment, I suppose, that could come back on that. As somebody who is a well-adjusted adult like yourself, Brian, you're hoping that when that feedback comes back, it's mediated through that experience to give it perspective and context. If you're a 13-year-old who, without that level of self-adjustment, then the feedback becomes crucially more important to you. And again, it's coming back to that idea that some people may be more vulnerable online than others in that sense. But to veer off the point, you know, that notion that you're saying the return from Twitter isn't guaranteed, that there's a bit of a gamble in what that is. In actual fact, I was reading something recently that's very interesting, that in actual fact, the more unpredictable the feedback, the more we will engage with it. It's almost that lottery type.
The stakes are increased if you don't know whether there will be a return.
Exactly, and sometimes feedback that seldom is wonderful, almost in that sense that, you know, the feedback that comes, so if you put 7 tweets up and they get very moderate responses, but the 8th tweet gets a lot, it heightens the impact and value of that one, which will almost, the gambler in us will want to go again. And you know, in terms of feedback, I mean, it is a gamble in the sense that, you know, if you put something up and you're refreshing the screen, and you know that circular thing that spins at the top of the screen, it's a bit like the slot machine. You know, what did I get? You know, and you're waiting for it. But it's not what did I get in terms of 2 strawberries and a berry. It's what did I get in terms of feedback about me. So it becomes something much more personalized, much more with a much more heightened emotional content, and something that has much, much deeper impact.
And of course, that little white number inside the red circle on Facebook as well. How high is that number? The social media platforms are optimizing themselves. They probably have psychoanalytical psychotherapists working inside their companies to game the system in their favor, to ultimately make us stay on and use their systems longer, because I don't see them being as very good at programming us to be seeing better advertisements, which I think the offering was supposed to be about, that if we're not paying for the service, we are the product and they'll serve us better ads. But they are making us stay on their platforms longer and longer.
Yeah. And I think these social media sites have cottoned on to the idea that emotionality is important. And I would use the Big Brother principle, you know, in terms of if you put, say, Celebrity Big Brother, and you pick, you know, 12 people, starve them of food, fill them with drink, and you watch what happens, what you're going to see is emotionality. You're going to see sparks fly. And I think some ways, if you take the example of certain social media sites where they used to ask you what you're doing, they now ask you how you're feeling, because emotionality makes for better telly. So I think, you know, there is a seduction in that it makes for better viewing if we're encouraging people to be more emotional in those sites. And again, I think young people are vulnerable when it comes to emotionality, because, you know, your phone ceases to be a phone, or your Facebook ceases to be that when you start to engage emotionally on it, in the same way that a copybook ceases to be a copybook once it becomes a diary. You know, there's a kind of a sense that we create an emotionality with the device and with that relationship, which in actual fact is high risk, because it's an emotionality, it's a diary. You know, it's almost like somebody said, you know, a few years ago, if someone read your diary, you'd be horrified, whereas now if nobody reads your diary, you're horrified, in that sense that we've become more publicly open about things. But again, I would hasten to add that I think that brings out vulnerability in certain people that people need to watch out for.
How would you react to the comment that humankind, you know, can adapt to these situations in jig time and are adapting all the time, and will take this on board and will deal with it.
Yeah, I think we are adapting. I think it's scary how new this is. You know, in terms of it's interesting to know that the banking crisis is older than the iPhone. I mean, it doesn't seem that way, but really, I think that the smartphone, the handheld device, has been a game changer in that. I mean, people will say the internet's been around since the 90s, but for the majority of us, it really was. The handheld device allowed us to have a very unique one-on-one relationship with tech that was never there before. Because if I had been speaking to you 5 years ago, I'd be saying to you, you know, leave the PC in the sitting room, keep an eye on it, and you'll be fine. Whereas now the unique connection with devices has made it much more secretive and much more unique and much more special. But the adaption, I've no doubt that we will adapt, but I would worry that we will lose out on something. And I think the pace with which we have to adapt to this is a pace that we can't keep up with. And I think there is traditional, and I think as adults, it's easier to adapt when you have the established coping mechanisms in place. If I'm listening to the radio and I miss something and I say, God, I'd like to rewind that, and then I go, oh, I can't rewind the radio, I can kind of say to myself, oh, come and cop onto yourself, get on with it. But as a young person who's born into that world and it has become the fabric of my being, there are skills that I don't get a chance to develop. And that's the worry I have. It's not so much for us as adults, but as young people who are born into a world that is moving so fast, I worry that there's things that are going to be missed.
Are those things like robbing an orchard or kicking a ball or not getting picked for the team? Are we less in the outdoors, as you were saying earlier? Are we, do we emotionally not develop because we're not doing those things anymore?
Yeah, and I think there's a case for that. I mean, I just to make the comparison between, but again, my area is more about emotionality, so that's my concern. But I think in some ways, because children now are, you know, we have kind of, we sterilize everything when they're children, and we have this kind of very clean, pristine environment for young babies, we notice there's increase in things like asthma, and people are kind of hyperallergenic because they haven't been exposed to these things. It's almost like, I think technology allows us a kind of a very sterile psychological exposure, and children are maybe hyper reactive to emotionality, that perhaps things that would have built up resilience in us over the years, children are not getting an opportunity to do. And I would be an advocate that would say I'm against the snowflake generation, that these children are, you know, they're weak or they're not strong. I think they haven't been given the opportunity to learn to deal with emotionality and disappointment and frustration, and allowed to develop those kind of skills. My worry is that we will adapt, but we will throw the baby out with the bathwater in some respects, that we will discard some really important things, and they might be learning to wait, learning to tolerate frustration, learning to be bored. These are things that I think are important developmental steps. A colleague of mine is a public health nurse, and she recently spoke to me about, you know, the block building tests for development, that children are coming now and they're not able to do the block building, not because they can't do it, but because they've never seen a block. And I think there is something fundamental in that we may be able to develop new skills, but what is being missed in the acquisition of those skills?
Tell us about Cop On.
Cop On, I mean, for me, that's the most undervalued skill. And it's an Irish colloquialism, you know, that describes kind of our ability to react to something in a proportionate way. So if something happens,
it's more to have cop on rather than to tell someone cop on to yourself.
I think it's both. I think in some respects, having cop on is a great skill. And I think it's oftentimes working in this area, people say, what would you like for your own children? And I would oftentimes say I'd like them to have cop on, which is that ability to see something for what it is and react in kind to it. But I think that's something that children have to develop, and I think they have to be able to be given skills to develop that.
They lost it?
I worry that they have. Right. Yeah, I think we live in a very anti-cop on society, where perhaps we're encouraged to respond to things with outrage or disinterest, and rather than a more measured response to things. And I think we tend to live in the extremes, and I would think that as a society we need to pull things back. So when I was writing the book around technology, I called it Cop On, because I felt that was the thing that was most needed and perhaps the thing that was most under threat.
Your top tips then to instill some cop on in young Irish people?
I think first thing is to we need to educate young people around their relationships with technology. I think that's and I think that's a shared responsibility between from a government, family, and school level. I think the idea is allowing people to be upset and allowing them to find ways out of that and helping children to develop their own resilience. But most importantly, I think it's as adults we have a responsibility to be good role models in terms of our own relationships with technology. 5 years ago, you'd hear parents say, "I can't talk to my daughter because she's stuck behind a screen." Now I hear parents say, or I hear young people say, "I can't talk to my mom because she's stuck behind a screen." And I think we've kind of adopted a "if I can't beat them, join them" type approach. You know, the most people who are moving on to Facebook in the last 5 years are people between the ages of 35 and 50. And so we're behind the curve, but we're almost picking up on something. And if you're telling somebody, "Come off your device, while I stay on my phone," you're kind of saying to them, you know, "Eat your porridge while I have a packet of crisps." And I think as adults, we need to tune into that and almost engage in some cop-on activities ourselves.
What about digital detoxing? Is it, you know, worth engaging with? Or should we just have timeout moments like the dinner table? Or how should we do it?
Yeah, I think we need to measure that. We need to have kind of sacred spaces where technology doesn't intrude. And in doing that, we're creating a value on that time, which I think is an important teaching children priority. But one young person said to me, "You know, I can turn off my phone, but I can't turn off my head." And it's an important aspect that, you know, just because we don't have the device in our access, it doesn't mean that our heads aren't still in there or worrying about, because that's the idea, that our devices represent us 24/7, and that's the thing you don't get the respite from, that's the thing you don't get the sanctuary from. So that kind of hum of anxiety is not escaped when you turn off the phone.
And unless you get rid of the phone for good and forever, it'll be there in a few hours when you turn it back on. We have been talking to Colman Nochter, a psychoanalytical psychotherapist with St. Patrick's Mental Health Services in Dublin, author of the book Cop On, which I would recommend you get a physical copy of. And if you can't get a physical copy, it's on Kindle, it's on Amazon, download as well. Thank you very much for your time. Final question, what do you do to unwind?
I play tag rugby very seriously on a Monday night, which I love, really engage in that. I love cars, so I dream about driving fancy cars and read lots of magazines around those things. And, you know, I try and play golf when I have a spare 5 hours.
Colman Nochter, thank you very much.
Thank you.
103.2 Dublin City FM. This has been Mental Wealth. If you want to email the programme, do so at mentalwealth@briangreen.com. We're back next Tuesday at 12:30. Stay tuned. Have a good week. Stay safe. Take care. Bye-bye.